Our first speaker this morning is Heath Emerson. His title is Knowledge in the Human Continuum.
Okay, so this is an application. It's a fairly unappetizing title, I think. In fact, originally I was going to talk about exclusively about this idea of duality in KK theory, but I decided to focus more on the applications of duality. And the application that I have in mind is to an elaboration of the classical Lefschetz six-point formula. So let me just recall what the classical Lefschetz six-point formula says. First of all, so let's let M be a compact manifold. It could be a finite complex. This would make sense, at least the first part. And suppose we have a self-map of this manifold. Then, of course, it induces a map on cohomology with rational coefficients. And its Lefschetz number is the trace of the induced map. So it's the graded trace, the trace on the even part of cohomology minus the trace on the odd part of cohomology. And the trace of a map, of course, it only depends on the homotopy type of the map, but a little bit better, it depends only on the conjugacy class of the map amongst self-maps of M. It's an invariant in this sense. And the Lefschetz six-point formula, which is sort of one of the cornerstones of topology, it's now maybe seems sort of trivial to us, but it's very important, of course, states that if F is in addition smooth and what I'm calling generic, which means that his graph is transverse to the diagonal in M cross M, then its Lefschetz number can be computed in terms of the fixed point set of F. So this is sort of an early index theorem. The first index theorem, the left-hand side is global. It depends only on the action of F on homology, cohomology, and the right-hand side is local and geometric.
This statement is, of course, the correct statement. This is Lefschetz's statement. This has nothing to do with the statement. The statement has nothing to do with M being oriented or orientable. Do you need the hypothesis that M is orientable?
No, you do not.
It's true, like it would be true for the Klein model or something like that.
Yes. So I'll come back to this point. But you do not need it to be orientable to prove this.
It's true for non-orientable manifolds.
That's right. To some extent, it's even true for manifolds with singularities. These are adaptations of the Lefschetz formula to varieties of singularities and so on. But the first point I want to make is a very sort of elementary one, which is that it makes a lot of sense to, well, again, this is a very simple point, but it makes sense to elaborate the Lefschetz formula in the following way. So suppose that X is not connected and it has a bunch of components, has more than one component, and then in this case the homology, of course, is a direct sum of the homologies of the components. Now, so if you have a self-map of X, M became X here. If you have a self-map of X, then it permutes the components, but any component which is not fixed doesn't contribute anything to the Lefschetz number. So if we just agree that the Lefschetz number, so the Lefschetz number, in other words, will be a sum of the Lefschetz numbers of the self-maps of the components which are left invariant. But that means, again, this is a very simple point, that means that it's quite reasonable to think of the Lefschetz number as assigning a number to each component which is fixed and therefore is defining an element of the zeroth homology of X. Okay, so it's, again, a very elementary point, but it suggests that we should think of Lefschetz numbers as not just numbers, but as homology classes. They're zero-dimensional homology classes. And of course, this is backed up by the, as it were, by the right-hand side of the formula, which is the number of fixed points, which in a very obvious sense is a homology class. A bunch of points. Okay, so the second point I want to make along the lines of elaborating the formula, the Lefschetz fixed point formula, is that in principle you could talk about the Lefschetz invariant of a, well, just any map on homology. That wouldn't be very interesting because these are not geometric objects. A little bit better would be to say that it makes sense to talk about the Lefschetz number of a map of, a self-map of the complex of forms on X. So suppose we have a map from just the a linear map from the complex of forms on X with the Durand differential, which is degree K, so I'm assuming it's homogeneous, so it maps forms of degree I to forms of degree I plus K, and it's closed in the sense of the second line. Then such a map induces a map on cohomology, and so we can take its Lefschetz number. The point is that you get these keys from geometric constructions. For example, you get them from correspondences from X to X, but I'll come back to this. Well, an obvious point is that since if you have one of these T's of degree K, then it moves things around, and so its trace will be zero unless K is equal to zero. So you only get Lefschetz numbers for degree zero things. But this changes the perspective a little bit. Now we're wondering whether there isn't a sort of higher Lefschetz number that you can attach to a degree bigger than zero T, like this. Okay, well, here's just a very simple example. Of such a T, if you take a closed current on X and take a closed form, then by this, you can define this sort of rank one operator, which maps omega to pair omega with C and multiply by tau. So that's an example of a T, which doesn't come from a map. And the Lefschetz number of this is you just contract tau and omega. Okay, so these are just some preliminary comments. So what I'm going to do, I can phrase in completely elementary terms, well, in these terms. I'm going to show how, in fact, you can associate to any compact manifold X a map denoted left from the bivariant homology of X. So this is just equivalence classes of T's as on the previous slide. There's an obvious notion of one of these T's being exact. And if you mod out by exact T's, then you get what we could just casually call the bivariant homology of X. I'm going to define a map, but this is its domain, and with the range being the homology of X. It's a degree zero map, so if you have a degree zero thing on the left-hand side, then you get a degree zero thing on the right-hand side, which is somehow right, because remember, we should sort of get points for degree zero things. And, well, if you have a higher degree element of the left-hand side, you get a higher degree, higher dimensional homology class.
Is this bivariant thing, in fact, isomorphic to the tensor product of homology and cohomology?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Now, what is the, and also this map is going to satisfy this invariance, this tracial sort of property, which is that the, it's essentially invariant under conjugation modulo this, the invariance property is given by this formula. And furthermore, in some sense, this map is going to be defined in a geometric way, and so that we can compute it in specific situations in geometric terms. Okay. And the last point is that at the level of actions on homology, it's going to turn out that this Lefschetz construction acts in the following way. So if you take a homomorphism in bivariant homology group and you pick off its Lefschetz invariant, if the morphism is K dimensional, then the Lefschetz invariant is k-dimensional. If you pair this with a k-dimensional cohomology class, of course you get a number, this is going to turn out to be equal to the, so it's related to traces again, and ring multiplication on cohomology will be equal to, you compose the induced map on cohomology, which remember has degree k, with ring multiplication by x, which has the degree of X. So this formula means that we're only going to pick off non-trivial Lefschetz invariants for things which have degree, which have negative degree. Okay, so we need things of negative degree. So if you have an F now which has degree k, where k is negative, then it will pair with an X which has degree negative k. And that will be equal to this trace combined with ring multiplication. So this is how you get sort of higher Lefschetz invariance in terms of the action on homology by building in ring multiplication. Okay. This is all very elementary, but we discovered this by studying KK theory. And this is the context that I'm going to stay in from now on. So we can think of this, if you don't like or don't understand KK theory, you can just think of this bivariant homology theory that I started with. But this construction is very general, so it works in this context. So let's let G be a locally compact groupoid, and X be a G space. And so we can think of the case where the groupoid is a group, of course. So this is the case where the unit space of the groupoid is just a point. And then to say that X is a script to G space just means that the group acts on X. We can also think of G being the holonomial groupoid of a foliation. This is a very good example. And X can be, if the manifold being foliated is, a good example to think of is the case where X is actually equal to G, in which case G acts on X, and just by multiplication, groupoid multiplication. But more generally, you can take a closed subset of X, look at all morphisms in G which begin in that closed subset, then by composition on the left, you get an action of G on this X, and it's, the important point that I haven't mentioned is that the action is sort of defined as proper. Okay, so actually throughout the talk, I'm going to be thinking about proper actions. So the action of G on X, throughout most of the talk, will be a proper action. But for some things you need it, for some things you don't. So this is the context. Yeah.
What is the holonomial groupoid acting
on? It's acting on, X. So it's, if you take an arrow which begins in F and you compose on the left, then
it's
you get an arrow
on the left.
It's acting on X, which is a manifold in this case.
Is that a problem? Is that a proper action? What is
it's a bundle of manifolds. Yeah, this I believe is a proper action. A good example is when F is the... So if you take F to be the entire manifold, and in that case you're just getting the action of G on itself. If you take F to be a transversal, in which case you get an action of...
For the G space, you need the vibration over...
Yeah, X
is... ...the group of the space of units of G.
Exactly. Yeah, you should think of it as a bundle of manifolds. Yeah, not a manifold.
You're saying that for the chronic foliation of S1 across S1, the action on the
whole
groupoid is
a proper action? Well, it's acting on this very big space. The space X is all...
Yeah, that was my question. Let's say we take the chronic foliation of
S1
process 1.
Yeah.
Right, this has a certain whole groupoid.
Yeah.
What is that whole, from your point of view, what is that whole groupoid acting on?
It's acting on the space X, which is the sort of...
Acting on S1 cross S1?
No. This is non-compact. This X is non-compact.
So, I didn't really answer my question. My example is we take the chronic foliation.
Yes.
We take the chronic foliation of S1 cross S1.
Mm-hmm.
Usual thing.
Right.
The holonomial groupoid consists of pairs of points which are on the ordered pairs,
mm-hmm.
which are on the same leaf.
Right.
That's the holonomial groupoid.
Right.
Now, in your example, what is that acting on? So my question is very simple. What is it acting on?
Well, so it's acting on sort of pairs such that Well, it depends on what F is, but if you take F to be transversal, then it's actually on pairs such that one of the elements is, one of the components is in the transversal. So this is something, I think this is F1. Yeah, this is the action of R on S1 cross R, or something like this. But it can be, let's come back to this later.
It strikes me as unlikely that these are proper actions.
Okay, well, let's come back to this a little bit later. It's, what we want to do is define a...
No, that's my whole question. What is it acting on? If it's acting on itself, of course, it's a proper action.
Okay, well, let's just take F to be the...
Okay.
Let's just take F to be the entire manifold so that we don't, so as to avoid controversy.
Okay? I will exercise some proper moderation.
Okay, so I want to define a map like, which similar to the one on the previous slide, which has this form. So it's a map from the equivariant KK group of G acting on X to the equivariant homology group of X, and it's going to be a sort of, in some sense, an elaboration of a trace, because it will satisfy the invariance property that was on the previous slide. But it takes values not in numbers, but in equivariant homology classes. So we should think of this as something like a trace. Okay. So the construction uses, of course, as I mentioned, the notion of duality in KK3. Now, which is the following, and this is a very general sort of idea. When you take a G-space X, then we say that it has an abstract dual if you can find a G-sister algebra P and a class theta in some equivariant KK group such that this composition denoted PD is an isomorphism for all G-sister algebras A and B. Okay, so what you do to get this map is you start off in the group KKG of P tensor A comma B, and then you apply the homomorphism of groupwise that goes from G cross X to G, and this by functoriality induces a map from KKG to KKG cross X, and then you take a Kasparov product with this class theta. So this is sort of, so it involves the groupoid homomorphism from G cross X to G, followed by Kasparov product. And you need this to be an isomorphism in general. This is the definition. This is phrased in such a way that we will be able to show that duals are functorial. But it's sort of clear from the definition that this would be hard to verify in any specific situation, because there's no, you don't know what the inverse map should look like. And of course, the way you always check that something's an isomorphism is by finding an inverse map, and it's not clear what the inverse should be to this map. So it would be difficult to verify this in an example, but it's good for functoriality. In fact, the following, you can prove the following. If you have two G spaces, each of which has an abstract dual, and you have a G equivariant map between them, which is not necessarily proper, then it induces a morphism in KKG from P sub X to P sub Y. Right? And this is functorial in the sense that if you use the same, so if X is equal to Y, and you use the same dual, then the morphism corresponding to the identity map will be the identity element of KK, and if you use different duals for this same G space, then you get a KK equivalence between the two duals, which intertwine the thetas in the obvious sense. And more generally, if you have an X, Y, and a Z, and you have each of which has a dual, and you have maps from X to Y and Y to Z, then these induced morphisms compose. Yeah, actually, I was going to say that before. I forgot. An abstract dual is just I mean, that's why it's called an abstract dual. It's a very flabby sort of thing. If you have, if G is trivial, then the existence of an abstract dual, I think, is equivalent to the K3 being finitely generated. So you can build one of these. Yeah, yeah. Just about everything you can.
The dual is not a space.
That's right, yeah. The dual is not a space. Yeah, so the classic example, there are two sort of classic examples that arise in geometry, which is the case where you have a manifold and the dual is continuous functions on the tangent bundle. And an non-commutative example is when you use the Clifford algebra of the manifold.
In general, does the dual interchange K-theory and K-homology?
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of obscured by these by the sort of strange-looking KK groups that you have here. If G is trivial, then this, and X is compact, then this is just the K theory of, well, you have A and B, but this is just the K theory of X, and that's the K homology of P.
And you have this example with P of X, and it's dual, or it was
Yeah, so the classic example is when X is a, let's say the X is a compact manifold and G is trivial, then you can take P, there are two sort of famous examples, one where P is the Clifford bundle, sections of the Clifford bundle of X, and the other is where P is functions on the tangent bundle. Yes. But you need to formulate things in this complicated way with all these strange KK groups when X is non-compact because of the different behavior of K-homology and K-theory with respect to direct sums. You can't have K-homology being dual to K-theory. It has to be dual to what's called representable K-theory.
I think it's interesting to the Meyer version.
Well, this is crucial, actually, in Meyer. So a good example to... But it's not quite this duality. It's a little bit. So there's another. You could also talk about where you had X here, C naught of X here, and then something involving P here, and that would be relevant to Bohm-Kant because for X being C naught of E bar G. So in Meyer and S, you want to identify this KKG of C naught of E bar G, comma C, say. With a K-theory group involving this dual object, P. And so actually, that's related to this, but it's a different type of duality. And I was originally going to talk about this other type of duality and the connections to Bohm-Kant, but I think I won't, because I don't have time. Okay, so remember there's this difficulty with this definition, which is that it would be... It's obviously, you know, a definition that would be difficult to sort of verify, a condition that would be difficult to verify in practice. However, you can do something which works. If it happened that your algebra P was a what's called a G cross X algebra, so if it's fibered over X, it's morphisms going between the fibers, then you could define a potential inverse map by the following procedure. So, a sequence of maps here. The first map is, remember, P is a C of X algebra, so there's a tensor product, which is tensoring over X in KK G cross X. So that goes from here to here. So you're tensoring pointwise with P, as it were. So you're tensoring over X. And this defines a functor from KK G cross X of C naught of X tensor A, C naught of X tensor B to KK G cross X of P tensor A, P tensor B. And then you can just forget, if you have a G cross X algebra, you can just view it as a G algebra and forget the X structure, and that defines a map here. So that's a forgetful map. And then you can multiply on the, well, on the right by a class D, which lands you here. So D is the preimage of 1 under Poincaré duality. So 1 means, well, so you have a Poincaré duality goes like this. When the coefficients are trivial, it goes from KKG of P comma C to KKG cross X C
synod of X from the synod of X. And there is a unit, an identity in this KK group here. So that corresponds to some V here. And in practice, you could compute, I mean, this would just amount to computing one element, so you could find this D, and the rest of the maps are completely geometric, so you could compute this, so this composition is completely computable in practice. And you can write down a short list of axioms which ensures that this inverts the Poincaré duality map. Okay. But of course, there's no guarantee in general. I mean, if somebody just hands you an abstract dual, there's no reason to think that P should be a C of X algebra. This is a way of sort of formalizing mathematically the idea that you want a geometrically defined dual, like the tangent bundle or like the Clifford algebra. Okay, so this is just to make a point about this. It's kind of curious because, well, remember the map, the original map, the original map PD, which we're trying to invert, as I mentioned, just corresponded to some abstract setup. It didn't depend on an X structure on P, the map PD. But I just claimed that in certain circumstances, you can invert this map using an X structure. Of course, it follows that the inverse map doesn't depend on the X structure because it's inverting a map which doesn't depend on the X structure. So this would seem a little bit mysterious, and I just want to make a couple remarks about it, which I think are, maybe they seem a little bit arcane, but I think that they're a little bit interesting. So if you have a Poincaré, if you have a duality, an abstract duality, then it comes along with this class theta, and if you multiply, if you square theta, it determines a class in KKG cross X, C naught of X tensor P tensor P. And if you Poincaré dualize that, you get an element in KKG of P comma P tensor P. And so this looks like a co-multiplication for P, and in fact it is. It's a co-associative, co-commutative, co-multiplication, and the co-unit is this D. But this class, of course, only depends, by its definition, on PD. It doesn't depend on any X structure that might be there. And here's what you can show. Remember this point, when I was defining the inverse to Poincaré duality, I used the X structure. Where did I use it? I used it in this tensor product map, which is the first map. Because you're tensoring over X. Remember I said that. And so that depended on the P having an X structure. So I'm calling that TP right here. So this, in fact, you can show that this the composition of TP with the forgetful map, even though we define it using an X structure, in fact, it doesn't depend on the X structure. It can be formulated purely in terms of this co-multiplication, which in turn came from the abstract duality that we started with and doesn't depend on the X structure. Okay. So this is actually quite important in understanding the functoriality of duality. Yeah. If it's a trivial groupoid, then all this goes through. It's still non-trivial. Yeah. Now, in fact, so I can actually bet there's an analog of this in cohomology. And what it does is, in cohomology, if you have the the analog of the class theta, it's in the nth Durham cohomology compactly supported cohomology. Compact supported cohomology of X cross TX. Actually, let me assume that X is orientable. It's just a little simpler to describe what's going on there. And this is the Tom class of the diagonal. And if I remember correctly, so this map, this element, so
this is given by a morphism from forms on X to forms on X cross X, if you like. And what it does is it sends a form omega to omega multiplied by this cross state. Well, this, you pull it back using the first projection map to a form on X cross X, and then you multiply it against theta. Something like this. This is the co-multiplication in that case. So it's kind of an interesting... With P as the tangent model? These are
it's the Gleason map associated with the embedding of the diagonal.
Yes. That's right. Yes, that's right. That's right. You Poincaré dualize the diagonal. That's right. Yeah.
In other words, it's dual to the homology.
Exactly. It's dual to the class that I'm about to present. Yeah, so this is exactly right. So if you embed X into X plus X using the diagonal map, this determines the class in the setting of KK, and KK G cross X is C naught of X cross X, comma C naught of X. And this, in turn, determines a map from, by Kasparov product, from KKG of C naught of X comma C naught of X to KKG cross X, C naught of X cross X comma C naught of X. So what you do is if you have a morphism here, then you multiply it in the second variable. You compose it in the second variable with the class determined by delta sub X. So what this does intuitively is it takes, if you had an element of the domain, this map, which is given by an actual map from X to X, then the element that you get here is represented by the graph of F. The graph of F determines a class here. The distinction between these two groups, the domain and this group here, is sort of that because the graph of even a non-proper map still determines an element here. So you can think of this as similar to this, except containing morphisms that are somehow not proper. Okay, so using the diagonal embedding, you get a map from this to this, and then using Poincaré duality, or rather the inverse of Poincaré duality, you get a map from this to this, and then you can compose, so this is the unit space of the groupoid. If the groupoid is just a group, then this is just C. And what you then do to get the Lefschetz map is you multiply on the left by the class, essentially by the class theta, not exactly the class theta. The class theta was in a KK G cross X group, but you just forget about the X structure in it, and you can think of it as a class here. And as such, you can just compose with multiplication by theta and land here. Okay, so I sort of said it at the top of the page, but this, by definition, is the Lefschetz map that I'm aiming for. Okay. And again, if G is a group, then this is just C, so this would be the equivariant cohomology of X, and its domain is, KKG of XX. Okay, and it does indeed satisfy the invariance property that we wanted. We can think of this map as being an invariant of the, therefore we can think of this map as being an invariant of the proper G homotopy type of X. It's a map which is an invariant of the space, satisfying this invariance property. Okay, so let me just, before I give any examples, let me just observe that if you don't like invariants, which are equivariant cohomology classes, somehow this is, you can also produce numerical invariants by the usual procedure of mapping to topological K-theory and then mapping to the K-theory of the reduced Feistel algebra and then applying the map coming from a transverse measure on G. So this gives you L2 Lefschetz invariance, if you like. And, well, these correspond to the usual, I haven't really given any examples yet, but you can, in the situation of a foliation, you can recover the L2, and with a transverse measure, you can recover the L2 Euler characteristic of the foliation in this way. But let me explain that now a bit more. So here's a geometric example. So let's suppose that X is a bundle of Riemannian manifolds, and let's suppose that the group, the morphisms involved in the groupoid action are isometric. Then you can build a dual P, which uses the Clifford bundle. So in this case, we actually have a bundle of manifolds, not a one manifold, so it's the fiber-wise Clifford bundle that you want to use. And you can build a dual that you, where this D, remember this D, is the fiber-wise Durham operator suitably interpreted, and the theta is some sort of Thom class. And if you compute in this dual, the image of the identity morphism in KKG C naught of X comma C naught of X, then you get the leafwise Durham operator on X. It's a trivial computation. You just compute. It's very easy. One of the things that Ralph and I did I mentioned this is joint work with Ralph Meyer. I always seem to forget to mention this. One of the things we did is the case where G is a group. Something that you could do is you can take a space might have more than one dual, and so you can compute the image of, say, the identity under two different using two different duals. And since the results must be equal in KK, you get a sort of index theorem. And so, for example, what we did in the case where G is a discrete group, we computed the Lefschetz invariant of the identity using the Clifford dual, and we got the Durham operator. And we computed the Lefschetz invariant using a dual built out of a triangulation, an invariant triangulation of X. And what we got in the latter case, when you do the computation, was some zero-dimensional K-homology cost like this. This is obtained by inducing some characters from the isotropy to get these sort of point classes in K-homology. And so, as I say, it follows that the class of the Durham operator is equal to this zero-dimensional K-homology class. There's sort of one point for each orbit of simplices. Okay, so here's the real example. Here's the real, the most substantial application. There is a notion of correspondence, of course, that was from a space X to even to a space Y, invented by Paul and Alain and George Skandalis. And, of course, you can make this theory equivariant with a certain amount of work. And so what I want to talk about is the Lefschetz invariant of a correspondence. So what's a correspondence? Roughly speaking, we can sort of, it might be a good idea to forget about the groupoid for the moment and just imagine that the groupoid is trivial. Things are complicated enough, and there are lots of nuances associated with the general case anyway. So let's let the groupoid just be trivial for the moment. So what is a correspondence? You take a manifold W, a correspondence from X to X. You take a manifold W, and you take a proper continuous map from W to X, called G, and a K-oriented map from W to X, called F. So this, if F is a submersion, this would mean that the fibers of F can be K, admit spinsy structures. Okay, I want to assume that my correspondence is in general position in the sense that both maps are smooth and that the diagonal is transverse to this sort of obvious map here. Okay, so usual construction of Schrieck maps and functor reality gives a class associated to any correspondence, which is a KK morphism. And so we can try to compute the Lefschetz invariant of such a KK morphism. And the answer is quite beautiful, I think. Remember, in order to compute Lefschetz invariants, you always have to fix a dual, and you want to fix a dual which has a C of X structure, which has an X structure, or else you can't compute. So if you do the computation with the tangent bundle, then this is what you get. The Lefschetz invariant of the correspondence is the sort of obvious fixed-point set of the correspondence. If you take the set, you can prove that in the situation of the previous slide, this sort of fixed-point set, equalizer, is a manifold disposed from transversality, and it's, moreover, it's canonically K-oriented. Okay, disposed from the combination of transversality and the fact that the map F was K-oriented. So you get a Spinsy manifold, and you can consider the Dirac operator on the Spinsy manifold. Now this space, this fixed point set, or coincident space, as it's sometimes called, admits an obvious map to X, so you can push forward the Dirac operator to X and get a K-homology class. And that... Yeah. And that's the Lefschetz invariant. Okay, so just to sort of...
What is the Lefschetz invariant?
The Lefschetz invariant, you form the space F. Actually, let me talk a little bit more about the space F. So suppose that the setting of the setting of the classical Lefschetz 6-point formula is where you want to compute the Lefschetz invariant of just a map, not a sort of higher dimensional KK morphism, just a map. And that corresponds to the correspondence where W is X, where the map F is the identity, and the map G is the map whose Lefschetz number you want to compute. So this is the classical situation. And what does the transversality assumption say? Well, it says that the diagonal the diagonal map W goes to WW is transverse to the map W goes to F of W comma G of W, so W comma G of W, which is the graph of G. So the transversality assumption is that the graph of G is transverse to the diagonal, so it's the usual transversality assumption. And what's this space W? It's just the number of fixed points. It's just the set of fixed points of the map G. Okay, so in that case, we're looking at the Dirac operator on a finite set of points. So it's just the obvious zero-dimensional homology class. Yeah?
So you push forward
well, it's the map which sends W to F of W,
okay.
Or G of W. So we've replaced points by these higher dimensional submanifolds of X, essentially, and then we take the fundamental class of this set.
The answer is a K homology class.
The answer is a K homology class.
On X?
On X.
On the original manifold X?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it's given, it's a sort of local, what's a geometric, geometrically defined K-homology class because it's just the fundamental class of some Spinsy manifold. And moreover, the Spinsy manifold, incidentally, it has the same dimension as the, so let me just say, the dimension of F is equal to the dimension of W minus the dimension of X. Therefore, the classical case, and this is what one would reasonably call the dimension of the correspondence, the classical case of a map corresponds to zero-dimensional correspondence, and the Lefschetz invariant correspondingly is zero-dimensional. It's a bunch of points. So if dim W minus dim X is, say, 1, then the Lefschetz invariant will be one-dimensional in the sense that this F will be one-dimensional, a one-dimensional manifold. What was your... Yeah. So what happens in this case is that... It's not transverse. Yeah. Yeah, so what happens is that if this is not bigger than or equal to zero, the Lefschetz invariant is zero. And geometrically, this is because you can, if things are low enough dimensional, you can just move it away from the diagonal. You can just perturb it so that it doesn't intersect the diagonal at all.
Is it still in some sense an intersection number with the diagonal?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
If your correspondence, the original the correspondence you are studying is 1 to finite, well, I mean, a point goes to at most finite with any point. And you then get an explicit local formula? It's happening?
So it's, you have in mind a subset of the...
I start with a point in X. I take its free image under...
So you have in mind a relation in X cross X.
Which has finite fibers.
In the sense that when you project, the fibers are finite. The intersection of the fibers with the relation is finite. This is like the case of a map, and then you just get a bunch of points as the Lefschetz invariant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, the sense in which this improves the classical construction is the sense in which you can let this be. So lots of, I mean, this is what people usually study in algebraic geometry and so on, either functions from X to X or relations inside X cross X. But this is the zero-dimensional case of this theory, so the sense in which this improves the classical situation is higher dimensional. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the issue is that when we're working equivalently, it's not always so clear that you can perturb to be transverse. This is... That's right, but this is not equivalently. Yeah.
Equivalently,
it's not so clear.
But this problem was tackled in a paper by me and Jonathan Block.
Yeah, Paul has some tricks that help to deal with this, actually, so, but it would take too long to explain. Vector bundle modification.
Yeah, there's a way of sort of enlarging the situation and using Bach that you use instead of transversality.
Yeah.
It's in an old paper a long time ago by Jonathan Bloch.
So the opposite is that should be
imposed. Oh no, you cannot impose the condition in the equivariant case because you would have too few examples.
No, but so the point is, I haven't worked through the details of this yet, but I think that at a reasonable level of generality, you could take an arbitrary correspondence from X to X, and you can apply these, alter it geometrically to make it transverse, in this sense, using the trick of poles.
And Jonathan Bloch.
Okay, so, by the way... Sir?
Where is Jonathan? Why isn't Jonathan here?
I don't know. Is he supposed to be here? No, he wasn't. Okay, so by the way, let me just conclude with this sort of, you got a sort of nice, sort of beautiful Lefschetz formula now, because let's again just assume that G is trivial for simplicity. If you have, if we take a correspondence that's known to this group, and we get a class in the k-homology of X, so you can pair such a class with an element of the k-theory of X, so if I'm denoting by little x, and get a number, and this number, say that X is represented by a vector bundle on X, then this number admits two descriptions. One, a geometric description is obtained by twisting the Dirac operator on F by X, by the bundle, and taking the index, which has, of course, a local formula. And the other description is you take the map on K3 induced from the correspondence, and you compose that with ring multiplication by X. And then you take the trace of that, which is global. Okay, so I'm done.
Any questions or comments? Yeah. Well, your manifold F that you are working with is not assumed to be oriented.
That's right.
So your basic elliptic operator that you are working with is the Durham operator. But if you put it, so this is classical left yet, although you have generalized it in a very interesting way. But then there is also what T.M. Bach did, the so-called Wood-Hole theorem, where you put an extra structure on the manifold. The manifold will have some other interesting operator, like the Dbar operator or the Dirac operator. In other words, it seems to me this is made to order for that. Why can't you work with that and get a generalization, not just of classical Lefschetz based on the Durham operator, but of the Woods Hole fixed-point theorem, which was based on Dbar or Dirac.
Yeah. People always ask me this. I haven't found a clever, succinct answer to this. They're just two different types of generalizations of the classical Lefschetz formula. And this applies, I think this is more interesting because it applies to the equivariant setting and for bundles of manifolds, groupoids, and so on. And it's also higher dimensional. So, I mean, it has merits. But it does not generalize the classical formula in the sense that the Atiyah Bhatt formula does.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
No, I understand what you're
saying. What you're saying is take the Atiyah Bhatt thing as your starting point. You should be able to generalize that.
No, you can't. But you no, you can't because
collecting.
No, I don't think you can because the Atiyah Bhatt. So, in Atiyah Bhatt is not an integral formula. You can get continuously varying Lefschetz invariants if you like, and they have lots of examples for. With the Dalbo complex.
Yes.
So there's sort of no way that you could get a Atiyah Bhatt by KK theory or these types
of things. The local numbers can vary.
Well, the Lefschetz numbers that you get from a Atiyah Bhatt do not have to be integers. They can vary continuously. But this is the theory. I mean, any sort of approach using K theory would sort of have to be rigid. So I don't think that.
Would you use the Dirac operator? You still don't have this kind of
thing? No. No. It's a different.
There's a whole industry proving rigidity theorems for the right
operator. Well, I've thought about it, and we have thought about it, and we eventually decided that they are just two different creatures.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Thank you.
Just a very basic question.
Yeah.
So is it true that all KK classes are C0 of X?
Very nice. I really enjoyed listening to
this. All came from correspondences of these classes?
Yeah, this is actually...
No,
they don't address this. Actually, a recent paper. So actually, we address this in our papers. We're using duality to try to prove this. This is a very.
It's
not a stupid question at all. I mean, this is a very difficult question. It's a difficult question, but it's true.